It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Someone who I don't think is quite so naturally nocturnal is someone that might be making a little bit of an effort to be awake at this time. And that is Dr. Brian Rosenwald, political and media historian and the author of a terrific book called Talk Radio's America. Brian, thanks so much for joining me on the radio.
Frank, it's always great to be with you. And I am pretty nocturnal.
You are? All right. Well, then we'll put you on later in the show going forward.
Hey, Brian, you get me better at 1:30 than you do at like 3 or 4, but I'm sometimes awake.
Fair enough. We'll keep that in mind. Brian, want to pick your brain on a few different media issues, a few different political issues, some stuff you've been writing about, and we'll see where that goes from there. One thing, you know, you understand talk radio, in particular conservative talk radio, better than almost any living person. And one of the things that a lot of our listeners that around the country are concerned about is the fact that George Soros, who obviously is on the leftward end of the political spectrum, has bought 40% stake in a large radio company, Odyssey, a company that owns several of the stations that we're on right now. And they're concerned that this might be the beginning of the end for conservative talk radio on those stations. What can you tell us, Brian? Is George Soros going to turn talk radio liberal all of a sudden?
As I understand it, Odyssey only owns a pretty small number of conservative talk stations. I would not, you know, rule out his ideology playing a role. There's a company by the name of Salem that it is driven by their founder to only program Christian conservative talk and Christian music. That they're a mission-driven company. Most of the other companies are driven by the bottom line, so they'll put on anything. So it's not unprecedented if that were to happen, but it's a relatively small number of conservative talk stations. And I honestly think that rather than Soros saying up, this host has to be gone, it might manifest itself in one of two ways. The first is I could see Soros saying to Odyssey, I want you to try liberal radio again. I want you to, you know, take some of your stations somewhere and let's try this format again. Nobody's tried it in years. No one's really ever put the money behind it that it would need to succeed. So I could see him trying that and trying to build a kind of liberal media operation. And I could see him weighing in when it comes to, if a host does or says something like think January 6th type stuff. Does or said something that's so beyond the pall, sort of the kind of thing that where eventually Fox said to Tucker Carlson, you know, you're too much for us. We don't want you anymore. I could see him weighing in on that. But it's important to note that this is the Soros Fund, and the president that I believe is a registered Republican. So I don't think that there's any huge worry out there, but it wouldn't shock me if eventually he says, okay, let me weigh in and let's do something here. But I don't think it'll be like wholesale, no more conservative talk on my station.
Got it. I would just like to add, in case anybody in Team Soros is listening, that I have nothing but respect for Mr. Soros, and he's undoubtedly made a lasting impact in his philanthropic endeavors, and that showcases a level of commitment that can only be admired. Of nothing but respect and admiration for George Soros.
George, if you're listening, put Frank on your station.
Exactly. All right. Hey, one of the things that we talked about last time you were on the program was the efforts by some car manufacturers to take AM radio out of cars. Since then, there's been a great deal of pushback. There's legislation that has bipartisan support from senators on the right like Ted Cruz and senators on the left like Ed Markey for different reasons. As best you understand it, Brian, what is happening right now with that AM radio legislation and the efforts by car manufacturers to try to take AM radio out of cars?
My sense is that this isn't going to happen immediately. I think probably it's sort of a tense situation between the backers of AM radio squaring off against the car manufacturer's favorite people on Capitol Hill, whoever those are these days. You know, John Dingell's not with us anymore, but that was always the guy who took care of the auto industry. But I'm sure that they're kind of squaring off over, does this get inserted into an appropriations bill or something like that? I think we talked about this before. I wouldn't be alarmed if I'm a fan of AM radio about the content going away. it may be that the delivery mechanism shifts, but you know, I'm a believer in markets, and where there's a market for something, and there is definitely a market for conservative talk, which is the most dominant format, I think, on AM radio right now. So that's not going to go anywhere. But I'm not sure what ends up happening, because you've got two pretty powerful interests here in terms of media companies going against car companies.
Well, the only thing I would add, though, Brian, is there's a lot of folks listening to us right now on AM stations that tend to be older, and they don't want to learn or acquire a new delivery system when there's nothing wrong with the delivery system they have. Not only are they relying on AM radio to enjoy this show, but they may rely upon it for things like traffic, weather, or in the event of a disaster like Superstorm Sandy, they're able to know what's open, where to get gasoline, and they don't want to necessarily have to purchase a smartphone in order to access the same information that they're accessing now for free. So I know we tend to often overlook people that might be 65 plus, 70 plus, 80 plus, but a lot of those folks are the folks most dependent on AM radio, and they're the folks most in need of protecting, and unfortunately, they're the ones that I could see getting most overlooked in this transition to a different delivery system.
That's absolutely right. You know, I think about my parents. They have smartphones. They're fairly technologically savvy. They're always asking me for help with something technologically. Just wait. Baseball season's about to start. Wait till the Phillies are on Apple TV Plus the first time, or Peacock, and I have to help my dad figure out how to find this.
Sure, we saw during the NFL playoffs what a big deal that was. They had the one game on Peacock.
That's right. You know, and it isn't fair to older listeners or viewers who have, you know, existed with certain media systems for decades, that now that they're being, you know, forced to find all these other things that are more complex to use and that are more alien to them. I think that from the car manufacturer's perspective, they're worried about some technical interference stuff. I think they're probably worried on some level that keeping AM radio with all of the gadgets and tech that they're putting into cars is going to end up being more expensive for them. And so they'll probably argue at some point, oh, you know, we could keep this in, but it's going to make cars more expensive for the consumer. But you're making a very good point that we don't think about older people, and we don't think about how much the technology has changed on them in recent years. And that it is a hardship on them. You know, even though, at least here in Philly, a lot of the stations that dominated AM when I was a kid have now shifted to FM.
One of the things that you cover, if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Dr. Brian Rosenwald, author of Talk Radio's America. One of the things that you cover in the book is basically how conservative talk radio took over the GOP, and how Donald Trump, by striking a lot of the same themes that your favorite conservative radio talk show host might touch upon, he was able to run roughshod over all of his better financed, better organized, in some cases better known, at least in political circles, primary opponents. And basically your book is about the premise of how the medium of conservative talk radio took over a party which ultimately benefited Trump. What is the impact on the political process and on the GOP of conservative talk radio these days? Specifically, what do you see the impact being on this coming election?
Well, I mean, I think we saw it again last night in Super Tuesday, where the right wing of the Republican Party had a really good night primary-wise. We saw it in Texas in a bunch of races where they're fighting over fairly esoteric kind of purity test stuff. You know, did you vote to impeach the attorney general? If so, you're not pure and conservative enough, no matter what. That kind of thing. We saw that there was a House race in Alabama with a primary, the governor's race in North Carolina. We're seeing people who more resemble talk radio hosts than, say, Mitch McConnell, one of those kind of button down, what do we have to do kinds of politicians, people who say outrageous things, people who valorize the values that for a lot of conservative Americans, they think are under siege. And I definitely think that conservative media continues to play a huge role in animating the Republican base, activating them, getting them to show up and vote, getting them to support Trump. And I think that they will be uniquely positioned if there are any conservative media consumers out there who waver on Trump if he gets convicted in any of these criminal cases. We don't even know if we're going to get verdicts, but if we did, sort of like they served that function with the Access Hollywood tape in 2016, where they said, look, we may not like this, but the other guys are hypocritical. They're not pushing this because they actually care about the morals. And, you know, we know that Hillary's going to be really bad. There's a chance this guy might be good. So they're positioned to do that. They don't have as much of an impact, I think, this cycle than they as they did in 2016 necessarily, because conservatives, their core audience, are much less skeptical of Trump now. They've seen it. They know they like it. They don't need to be sold on this. But it's still a great way for him to reach them, to get his message to them, to get them to donate, to volunteer, to get involved.
With crime running rampant in New York, you need to keep yourself and your family safe. Obtaining your concealed carry firearm licenses can be difficult and time-consuming. That's where MyFirstPistol.com comes in. They'll help you secure your concealed carry license. If you're looking for a pistol, premise, rifle, or shotgun license, call 347-559-7052. 347-559-7052. You must have a valid firearm license issued by the NYPD to purchase, possess, or shoot a handgun or pistol in NYC.
You had, by the way, you're doing some interesting work on Substack, where you have the world according to Brian. If people want to check out Brian Rosenwald's Substack, they can just go to brianrosenwald.substack.com. By the way, I know you have a paid subscription level as well. You know, wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, Brian, if you gave the Frankster a gratis paid subscription to The World According to Brian.
I should do that.
It should. You know, you might find some of what you're saying getting talked about on the radio, and then people will say, oh, well, read that article, I've got to subscribe. But there's a lot of great stuff on the free side of The World According to Brian as well. You just mentioned Mitch McConnell. You had a very interesting column about Mitch McConnell's legacy, who's obviously stepping aside as the longest serving or one of the longest serving Republican Senate leaders. You ask a question, how will history remember Mitch McConnell? What's your answer to that question? What is his legacy?
My answer is that history is going to remember him as enormously impactful. I don't think that the judgment will be as positive as conservative, what I call Reagan Republicans, think it should be. And I don't think it will be necessarily as negative as liberal Democrats think it should be, or populist Trumpers. I think that he has stood up to his own party a little bit on issues like Ukraine funding, especially. He was pretty outspoken after January 6th and worked to certify the results of the election. So he has been willing to stand up to those forces in his party going in a different direction, especially on foreign policy stuff. I do think that he's not going to go down. He wants to be remembered as one of the great Senate leaders of all time. He's always kind of venerated like Henry Clay and another Kentuckian and folks like that. And I don't think that we're going to see that. And I explain it in the column that a lot of the leaders that we remember in both parties who've been venerated like that have done something that is really courageous that hurts them politically, or that involves working across the aisle for something that looks to be for the greater societal good. Everett Dirksen was instrumental, the 60s Republican Senate leader, in the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the Open Housing Act. Howard Baker, the late 70s and early 80s Senate Republican leader, was instrumental in ratifying the Panama Canal treaties, even though he knew that it was probably going to cost him a chance of ever being president. Mm. So, you know, we don't have that kind of thing with McConnell. He had opportunities along the way where he could have done something that put country over party. And the thing with McConnell is he's maybe the most brilliant political and tactical strategist on the planet. And he's always kind of erred on the side of what is good for building and maintaining a Republican majority. That was always his goal. He thought that was good for the country. That was what he was trying to push. And he always advanced that, even when there were opportunities where he might have said, okay, I'm going to do something that's not as good for the party, but is probably long-term going to be good for the institutions of the United States and for trust, engendering public trust in those institutions. And he didn't really do that.
You mentioned Howard Baker just now. He comes up in another recent column you wrote called on the GOP's lurch to the right, where you talk about how Republican lawmakers these days are much more conservative than their predecessors. A lot of conservatives are listening to this right now and saying, well, I feel like people say this every year, that the Republicans are more conservative, the Democrats are more liberal. Are there any actual metrics to measure whether today's lawmakers, today's Republican lawmakers, are more conservative than their predecessors?
So we have this scholarly metric called DW Nominate that some political scientists have developed and compiled. And essentially, it scores every lawmaker in the House and Senate from -1 to 1. 1 would be the most conservative, -1 would be the most liberal. And as you get to 0, you get the most moderate. So it enables you, you know, it's not perfect. Any metric, there's a certain subjectivity of what goes into that. But it is really valuable from my perspective in comparing across eras. In saying, okay, how many guys were close to the center 25 years ago or 50 years ago versus today? And what you see is that guys who were considered conservatives, you know, Bob Dole was considered kind of like a conservative hatchet man in the 70s when he first got to the Senate, so much so that when Gerald Ford's trying to court the right to beat back the primary challenge from Ronald Reagan in 1976, he picks Dole as his vice presidential nominee. And today, Dole would be like the fifth most liberal Republican senator.
Wow.
Something like that. You know, like totally towards the center. I use the example of Al D'Amato, a guy who I'm sure that plenty of your listeners in New York
he still
remember.
Comes on WABC regularly. I think he's actually a contributor to WABC.
Well, there you go. He, you know, he's still out there, and he ran in the primary in 1980. He ran against Jake Javits, who was a liberal Republican senator, had been there since the 50s, was very popular. He ran against him as a conservative, explicitly branding himself as a conservative. And I think he was never quite that conservative. Back in his time, he was like the 13th most conservative or most liberal Republican senator in the Senate, but he would be like the second most liberal Republican senator today. So you can see that the whole everything is shifted. Everything is shifted to the right in both the House and the Senate. And what you see is that Democrats, if you look over 40 or 50 years, Democrats haven't moved as much. They've moved a little bit, and I think they've probably moved more in the last 10 years than they did earlier. But that it's very striking when you look at the Republican Party. I'll give you another example of a New Yorker. This isn't from the data, but the late Representative Sherwood Bowler, who was from upstate, who was a classic Rockefeller Republican. I interviewed him for the book, and he said to me, you know, they call John McCain a rhino, Republican in name only, as though he's too impure. He's too moderate. And he said, he's no more of a moderate than I am a communist. I went to school with him. I knew the guy like, this is ridiculous. So you have that kind of thing where the Sherwood Bowlers of the world are probably not Republicans anymore. They're not, there's no room for them. They don't feel like there's room for them in the party. And my big contention is we would do a lot better. I saw you tweet about Kristen Sinema yesterday. And I think we would do a lot better with 100 independent minded senators who are willing to work together to address problems and who don't conform to either ideological side, and who, you know, you're surprised sometimes at where they land because they're thoughtful and they look at individual cases and that kind of stuff. So I think it's bad as the parties stratify, you know, with Sinema and Manchin leaving the Senate, the last real moderate Democrats are about to be gone. And the next layer, like John Tester, could also lose and be gone.
Lastly, though, Brian, you know, I'm looking at the man that you rightly say is now the leader of the Republican Party these days, Donald Trump. And, you know, he certainly rhetorically is very hot. But if you look on actual policy areas and actual issues, he's much more moderate or even liberal than a lot of other Republican presidential nominees in recent years. He will not even entertain lowering the retirement age for Social Security. That's typically a Democratic position. Was vociferously against the Iraq War and has run a campaign, totally two campaigns, against this Bush-style foreign interventionism. He's been very open that he thinks the Republican recalcitrance on abortion and being too anti-abortion has cost them a whole bunch of seats. That doesn't sound, if that's the leader of the GOP, that doesn't sound like a party that's lurching to the right. Where does that fit in to your equation?
Well, what's interesting is I actually think Trump had a missed opportunity to realign our politics. I think that there's a pretty large pool of voters from some of the polling I've seen who are socially conservative, Although maybe not on abortion, but on other issues that we would call social conservatism. They define themselves as socially conservative, but they're economically liberal. I think a lot of them are non-white working class people, people who are active in African-American churches, for example. And I think that if Trump had actually had a more liberal economic agenda, like actually leaned in to some of the things he talked about, he could have realigned politics. I'm talking about, instead of infrastructure week being a running joke, had he done the Biden infrastructure bill? I'm talking about stuff like he talked a good game on prescription drug prices, but didn't actually, you know, take on the pharmaceutical companies. He made some feints at tax breaks that the rich use to avoid paying taxes. Like if he had cracked down on that stuff, if he had done some more organized labor stuff, even on things like guns, if he had done a little bit, you know, had moved a little bit policy-wise toward where he was rhetorically, he could have, I think, captured a pool of Democrats who would be open to a populist GOP.
Interesting.
But
interesting.
The GOP hasn't really come up with that populist economic
agenda. Yeah, that's one of the things I find so fascinating about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., because it seems like that's a lane he might be willing to occupy. Brian, we're going to have to end it there. Let's do this again soon.
Absolutely, Frank. Always great being with you.